I'm Joanna Dovin. This is On Crisis, bringing together PR experts, thought leaders, creatives, and CEOs here to start conversations and connect people with real-life stories in crisis communications. Today is no exception. I'm so excited about our guests today. I sat down with two executives of Aurora. What's Aurora? If you don't know, you soon will find out that this company is doing big things as we leap forward to a new world in self-driving technology, or autonomous vehicles, or as some call it, robot vehicles. We talk about what a self-driving future looks like, what it means for the everyday citizen, and how we get there. Hint, hint, how we get there really boils down to how good of a job the industry is doing in communicating to people and to legislators how this technology will be safer than the human driver. Aurora is a big deal. They're based in Pittsburgh. Thanks to Carnegie Mellon, they've set up a headquarters here, and they're growing very, very significantly. It's led by former Google, Tesla, and Exuber executives, and they recently acquired Uber's autonomous driving unit. This will bring their Aurora Driver to the world's leading ride-hailing network. That transaction valued the company at $10 billion and solidified their role as the most technically renowned autonomous driving leader. How exciting is it that we got to sit down with two executives there and talk about the importance of a long-term communication mindset, how to get over public misconceptions, and why aggressive communications on the company's safety-first commitment is paramount, especially as they seek to shape regulations for a whole new industry. Let's dive in.
Thank you so much for joining us for On Crisis. I'm so excited to have you guys as guests today because what you're doing in the world is really revolutionary, self-driving vehicles. With us, we have Gerardo Interiano and Farrell Urey with Aurora. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
So how are you guys doing? So someone's in Pittsburgh, someone's in San Francisco.
Yes, I would say I'm probably the most tired of the bunch since I'm the one on the West Coast. But for you, I believe it's the middle of the day.
And Gerardo, you're here joining us from Pittsburgh.
I am. I recently moved to Pittsburgh from Texas a little bit over a year ago.
Awesome, awesome. Well, welcome to Pittsburgh. I'm sure you're getting used to it. It's a very family-oriented town. You have young kids, so I'm sure you like it. So
we are liking it. It finally got some good snow, so the kids have been spending a ton of time outside, which has made it much easier to be inside and working from home.
Oh, it's the best. Best memories were playing in the snow when I was a kid in Pittsburgh. So let's get right to it. Talk to us about what is happening right now with Aurora. So you guys were going to come on earlier in the month, but I had a schedule conflict. So I'm kind of glad we waited because what happened between then and now is really a historic deal for your company with Uber ATG. And I have to say, as you know, being from Pittsburgh, having my company headquartered here, I'm just thrilled to see your company growing. So talk to us about what happened.
Yeah, so Aurora announced a few weeks ago that we would be acquiring Uber ATG. So it's a multi-part deal. So first of all, we're acquiring that team. Obviously, we're really excited about the talent and the technology that they have there and about the ability to be able to accelerate the deployment of the Aurora Driver. We believe that with this talent, with this technology, we'll be able to get the driver on our roads and into our communities more broadly and faster. Right. Our mission as a company is to deliver the benefits of self-driving technology safely, quickly, and broadly. And we think that this acquisition is very much in line and will help us deliver on that mission even faster. The other exciting part of this deal is that we've signed an agreement, a commercial agreement with ATG and with Uber that brings an investment from them. That's a $400 million investment into Aurora, and also has their CEO, Dara, sitting now on our board. This is going to be a strategic relationship that we will have with Uber going forward that, again, allows us to get that driver onto the roads and more broadly.
Yep. More brain talent to do something that is very complicated, faster, and safer.
No, absolutely, right? I mean, this is something that it's a really hard problem that we are trying to solve, and we've been working at it for a long time. We've been really excited about the progress. that we've been making, and to be able to bring that talent here in Pittsburgh, right, where we've been headquartered and we've had our offices here from the very beginning, to have the opportunity to increase our presence here, and to continue to double down, right? It's exciting time to work with PennDOT and the state government, with the mayor and Domi here in the city of Pittsburgh. We're excited to continue those relationships and continue to build on what we have been building over the last 4 years.
And with what you're doing, communications is so important, because people don't, the average person doesn't understand how this could possibly work. How could a car drive itself, and how could that be safe? And government relations and of course communicating to the government and to legislative bodies about how you're making it safe is existential to your business. How has Pennsylvania been in terms of, you know, allowing you guys to safely test vehicles on the road? And why are you here?
So, I mean, I think for the very beginning, right, we were here because of the talent, right? There's incredible talent that's coming out of Carnegie Mellon, right? We have two of our founders that are connected there. Two of them got their PhDs at CMU. One of them still continues to be a professor there. So it's an incredible talent pool that's coming, and not just out of CMU, right? Like, you have incredible programs at Pitt. And Pittsburgh continues to be a place where people want to move to, right? Like, as we talk about it, there's everybody who wants to move to California, and then there's everybody else. And so to have the ability to have options.
That's a good point. Yeah.
Yep. Like, you have.
No longer New York City. It used to be, you know.
So we have Pittsburgh, we have Bozeman, we have Dallas. We're excited with the ATG acquisition. We're going to be announcing other offices soon, right? And that's an opportunity for us to continue to attract that talent. But here in Pittsburgh, we've had an excellent relationship with the mayor and with PennDOT and the governor's office. In fact, Aurora was the first of all the AV companies here in the state to be able to have that relationship with PennDOT, and that PennDOT authorized for us to have our cars on the road. I'm the appointee from the governor to the Highly Automated Vehicle Advisory Committee, which the state set up to really advise PennDOT and the state on how it is that we test this technology, and more importantly, how do we deploy it? I think a lot of the conversations we're going to be having with PennDOT going forward is that it's not just about the testing and the development of this technology here in Pennsylvania, but that we need to begin to make the shift to deployment. You have examples throughout the country of states where they allow the testing to happen, but when it comes to the deployment of this technology, you have companies that are looking to go elsewhere because those states prevent it. And here in Pennsylvania, one of the things that is really important to us is that not only do we want to continue to develop and test this technology here, but we want to be able to deploy it. And in order to do so, we're going to have to work with government to change the law and make that happen.
Sure. And that's the whole... This is why you guys are on, because the communications is so important. And, you know, Farrell, your background is incredibly interesting. You worked for tech companies that were doing things that people weren't used to. So a Square, for example, people are used to paying with money and credit cards. And now we have to convince business owners and customers to, you know, not do that anymore. How has it been, in your role at Aurora, and how important has it been for you to sort of over communicate versus kind of laying low and just letting the scientists and the engineers kind of do their job?
Yeah, but I think there's a lot of interesting points there. One is the idea that it's not just touting a brand, but it's really defining an industry. And you saw that at Square, where before we could tell people that they should swipe their card with Square, we had to teach them about the concept of mobile payments, and safety was a big part of that, because people were reticent to just swipe their card at a farmer's market if they didn't understand what the technology was. And it's similar at Aurora. Before we even tell people that Aurora is the company positioned to be the leader in the self-driving space, we actually have to tell people what a self-driving future might look like. And so I think that makes this job really challenging, but really exciting. I think about if you're at Nike, for example, you absolutely have a lot of brand and communications work to do, telling people that Nike is the best running shoe. But what you don't have to do is introduce the concept of a running shoe to people. And that's a bit of a difference between working in an industry that's kind of brand new for people. And so I think something that Gerardo and I think a lot about is educating the public. So of course, working with government partners and working with reporters is extremely important, but we also want to directly talk to the public. And there's been some surveys out there that say, hey, the public is nervous or they aren't ready for a self-driving future. And instead of looking at that and saying, oh, you know, that's very worrisome, we really look at that and say, hey, that means we have a really big job to do, which is to educate people about what a self-driving future would look like and really what the benefits are for society when we have autonomous vehicles on the road.
So let's talk about that. What does a self-driving future look like? How are you guys explaining that?
Yeah, there's a few different benefits we think a lot about. And once again, and I know you're a communications pro too, so you would get this. We always want to position things in a way that's like, hey, what's the impact to you? So we don't just lead with, you know, big stats about what it means for production or something. We talk about like, what will your life be like if we have autonomous vehicles? So we talk a lot about safety and the 40,000 people that die on American roads every year and the ability to reduce those deaths if you know, self-driving cars are on the road. We talk about the idea that there's tons of parking lots right now when you drive through a city, and those parking lots could be turned into parks. We also think a lot about autonomous goods delivery and the idea that if you can get goods to move faster through delivery, they can get to your door. And I don't just mean goods like, hey, you did an online order, you were shopping, and hey, your new pair of jogger pants arrived, you know, faster than you were expecting. I actually also mean the transportation of vaccines, which is obviously very important right now, or the movement of foods or personal protection equipment. All those things we saw this year, especially how important the supply chain was and the movement of goods. And if we could speed up how quickly goods move because of autonomous trucking and autonomous vehicles, that would be fantastic for society.
So let me add one point there, Jonna. I mean, one of the things that we've heard here in Pennsylvania is, you know, dairy farmers, right? Like there are limits into the markets that dairy farmers can access because of the hours of service, because of the regulatory hurdles that they have to figure out when they're moving product from one point to another, right? Truckers have to rest. They have all these rules in place. So if it takes 3 days for something to get here, to get from one point to another, like there's limits on how long perishable goods can be on a truck in order for them to then be able to sell it. But if we can speed that process up and we can get product from one point to another because we don't have the human component in the same way, right? It's not that these jobs are going away. Is that these jobs are going to change. But if we can get the product there from one point to another faster, that means some of the farmers and some of the folks in the dairy industry here in Pennsylvania, that is a large industry for the state, are all of a sudden going to have access to markets that today they don't have access to. So the impact to these folks is very real. And that's one of the things that's probably the most exciting for us. It's that broad impact that this technology is going to have when it's not just about the movement of people, but it's also about the movement of goods.
Interesting. Yeah, there's so much to unpack there. I mean, from a safety standpoint, I think that hits home with a lot of people, including myself. I mean, a lot of people know somebody who died from a driver who was under the influence, or know somebody who knows somebody. For me, it was my cousin 3 years ago in Florida. And you think of how the technology that you guys are working on right now could impact those very stark statistics. So talk about that from a safety standpoint. Let's say, and I'm going hypothetical, so if you don't have the answer, that's fine, we can move on. But let's suppose I'm in an autonomous vehicle, but the person next to me isn't, and they're drinking and driving. Is that still safer? I mean, if it's not, you know, equal, if the vehicles aren't all autonomous, is it still safer if I'm in an autonomous vehicle? What do you guys predict?
So, I mean, it's absolutely safer, right? Like it's, if you think about for us as humans, right, like there's limited amount of information that we can constantly be taking in, right? Like we have our two eyes, we have our ears, right? Like we have what we see
on their cell phones, mm-hmm.
and we have it here, and we have kids in the car, we have cell phones, we have other distractions, right? But if you take all of the sensors and all the entire sensor suite and hardware suite that we put on these vehicles, and you think about radar and LiDAR and cameras, and the fact that they're looking at it from a 360 perspective, right? Like we can't see what's happening behind us, right? We can't see what's happening on the left and the right at the same time. So to our technology, it's just another data point. right? And it's constant. It's literally collecting hundreds of thousands of data points every single second. So there's this great video where we have where the car's going down the street and it's looking at two cars, right, in order to make an unprotected left-hand turn. One of the most complicated, you know, maneuvers to make as a human driver is an unprotected left-hand turn. So we're trying to figure out when does the car go in between these other cars, yet right here on the side, it's also tracking about 20 different people that are on the street wondering whether they're gonna jaywalk or not, right? So like to the vehicle and to this technology, it's just data. And so to be able to get our cars on the road, like you're not gonna have a distracted driver with a cell phone. You're not gonna have road rage. Like you take emotion out of it. You have a car that is constantly gathering this information and making a data-driven decision on what it is that it should do. So, I mean, safety is paramount to everything that we do. It is why it's the first word in our mission. And it's something that we constantly think about on how is it that we make our roads safer, because it is important to have an impact. I mean, to your point, I lost my best friend in a car accident at the end of high school. Or like so many of us have been touched by traffic fatalities, either directly or indirectly. And we believe that this technology will make this world a safer place.
So it's like you're having sort of having one set of eyes behind the wheel. This technology is giving basically exponential sets of eyes that are all looking around, keeping things safe.
Yeah, I mean, it's again, it's three different types of sensors, right? Like it's cameras, it's LiDAR, it's radar. It's constantly collecting that data. And in fact, with the Aurora First Light LiDAR, which is the LiDAR that we are just now deploying on our vehicles, which was part of our acquisition in Blackmore, this LiDAR allows us to see faster and to see further, right? If you think about traditional LiDAR, one of the challenges is you can't immediately make a determination on whether an object is moving towards or away from you and what the velocity of that object is. With this LiDAR, we can, right? So that's one of the things that allowed us to go into trucking. And it's why we've announced that trucking is going to be our first product, partially because of that acquisition.
So I also think, Joanna, I was just gonna mention, this is also brings up another interesting point, which is the importance of making sure that the public understands what their car can and cannot do. So right now there are driver assist systems out there that helps someone maneuver the road, but there's not like a massive deployment of self-driving vehicles. And so one of the jobs of our communications team and our government relations team is being really clear and using transparent language so consumers know whether, hey, they can be like totally hands off, literally, like I'm not gonna, you know, be taking over, or if it's driver assist where it's, hey, the car is gonna do a lot of things for you, but you need to be mentally aware so you can take over at any time. And at Aurora, we made a very conscientious decision that we would be building self-driving where a consumer is never expected to take over. And so it's either they're driving or they're not, but it's not this kind of halfway situation.
That's a really good point, because I've recently had two new cars. The first car, it was a minivan. It just didn't fit my personality, even though I have three kids. And there was almost too much technology in it that I was supposed to do and not do. And even just from changing the radio. And when there's, I think sometimes there's this, when there's too much tech, I don't know what to do, right? And that's one of the reasons why, and you know, the driver assist or whatever you want to call it, if you know, there would be something in front of me, sometimes it would slam on the brakes. And I'm like, hey, that car was turning and my foot was on the brake and I didn't always feel safe in it. And then I just got a different car that is, I think, there's a little bit less tech in it. And that's, I wanted either one or the other. I mean, cruise control is another story. That's nothing to do, you know, I don't want my hands are going to always be on the wheel. But that's a good point of clarification. The other thing I think is really important is for the consumer, I think of myself as somebody who's working a lot, how much productivity we lose in the car all of the time. Right now we're working from home, most of us, but there's gonna be a point in time when the world renormalizes and we're back into those really long, annoying commutes. And the amount of productivity that one could get back by not having to try to multitask while you drive, which isn't safe. But I can just imagine a world where I'm driving to New York to see a client in an autonomous vehicle and I'm on my laptop working. right, getting, you know, my workday done.
Yeah, I mean,
I think that's absolutely right.
Sorry, I want to say that the average commuter spends about 40 minutes a day in their car, right? Like, and that's in places, you know, like here, right? But if you think about folks, like some folks in California, you're talking like 2 or 3 hours a day. New York, similar, right? Like, so imagine that productivity that folks can have back just on your daily commute, much less when you start to think about those types of trips where we're driving to Washington, D.C. or Philadelphia or New York, and you can get that productivity back. But you're absolutely right. I think the efficiencies that you begin to get with this technology and how we structure our days and how cities build themselves, right? Farrell mentioned earlier, like the way that we think about cities and parking lots, right? Imagine if every single one of those parking lots becomes a park.
I never thought of that, but it makes so much sense.
You start to change things and you start to use your resources more efficiently.
Oh, I love that. So let's pivot a little bit to public perception right now in the industry, because it's certainly paramount to the success of the entire industry. Talk to my audience about some of the most common misperceptions of self-driving vehicles. What are you seeing in some of the polling you've done, surveys?
Yeah, I think one of them is what we talked about, of this difference that between self-driving and driver assist, and the feeling that people say, oh yeah, I have a self-driving car, and actually they don't. And that really shows the importance of transparency and language in ensuring people know what their car can and can't do. So some people think that it's already here, and that's actually not true. And then there's kind of the opposite side of things, where people feel that this will never get there, and they feel frustrated with how long it feels, it seems to be taking. And I think for that, it's our job to help people understand what the technology and like what it's involved in terms of building this technology, and why it must be challenging, and why it takes so long, and what we really need to do to get it right. I also think in terms of some of the research, we see, as I mentioned, people are nervous about the technology. And to that, we really say it's on us to educate them. And we also say we've seen that time and time again. So there's some funny examples that we think about, actually, where people just really didn't trust technology and came out with some odd predictions. So actually, when the first iPhone came out, there was a TechCrunch piece, one of the tech, you know, news magazines, where it predicted, "We predict the iPhone will bomb. The virtual keyboard will be about as useful for tapping out emails and text messages as a rotary phone." That's a quote I just get a kick out of. And I understand it, because people weren't sure what to expect. And then Newsweek magazine back in 1995, they ran a piece on the internet which predicted that the network would never amount to anything. And we even see that when horse and buggy was going to be replaced by the car, people were really dubious. And even with the printing press, people had questions. So I think those are some of the misconceptions, saying like, hey, I'm not sure if I want this in my life. And so the more we can expose people to our technology, the more people see our cars on the road, hopefully the more they'll understand it and be excited about a self-driving future.
Yeah, and it's getting to those early adopters. And I think the first early adopter are governments right now, right? State governments, getting them to allow for deployment, as you mentioned, Gerardo. What's the next step in that with regard to your work in Pennsylvania?
I think we're going to have to, here we're going to have to work with the legislature, right? Like, we're working really closely with PennDOT to create what those guidelines could look like, and what it is that the legislature needs to do in order to allow for these vehicles to be able to be deployed. But under PennDOT's current interpretation right now, we cannot remove the human driver from the vehicle whenever we believe it's safe to do so, right? Like, our commitment to our cities, to our employees, to all of our partners, is we will never remove the human driver from behind the wheel of a vehicle until we believe that it is safe enough to do so. So today, every single one of our cars has two safety drivers in them at all times. Any one employee at the company can shut down the entire fleet if they have any concerns from a safety perspective, right? Like, again, safety is really important to everything that we do. But we also don't want to be in a position here in Pennsylvania that whenever we get the technology to that place where we believe it is safe enough to do so, that we're not going to be able to do so because the laws don't allow us to do it. Whereas there are other states that do allow for that to happen already. So our goal is to work with the legislature and government to create that path to commercialization so that we can bring this technology to market and be able to deploy it here in Pennsylvania.
Well, I'm certainly pushing for it. I think, you know, too often, you know, our state, this is me talking, too often our state kind of waits a little too long. And I'm hoping that there's movement on this, because what you've done in Pittsburgh with Aurora to already help the community has been amazing. I mean, I saw Pittsburgh Public School students receive computers as a result of a partnership that you created. And I used to work with the public schools, helping them with crisis communications. And I know firsthand the digital divide that exists in the district. So you guys have been an amazing community partner, and we want you to keep growing in Pittsburgh. Talk to me about some other local initiatives you guys have been embarking on as you look to be a more cemented in Pittsburgh.
Yeah, so one of the things that we're probably the most excited about is our new headquarters. So we've been in Lawrenceville for the last several years. I think, and Farrell, keep me honest, I think this is going to be our fourth or fifth office since we opened up our first headquarters here. I mean, in 4 years, we've moved just as many times because we continue to outgrow our space. So, the growth is real. Right, to give you one statistic that just baffles me is Aurora today, right, before the ATG acquisition, is roughly 600 employees. Of those 600, 200 have been hired just during the pandemic, right? So there's 200, a third of the company has never had to go into an Aurora office every single day, right? There are some people that are going in because they need to, and they need to be able to continue to get their work done so that the rest of the company can continue to work remotely. But that's a huge amount of growth. So moving into our new headquarters on Smallman Street, so it's 16th and Smallman right across from the terminal. We're moving into that space sometime. Couldn't be more excited about it. And then probably one of the partnerships that we work with the most closely is Girls of Steel. So diversity and inclusion is something that's really important to us as a company. And I talk about it in a couple different ways. One of my favorite stories is that when YouTube was bought by Google, 10% of videos were uploaded upside down. And the engineers were trying to figure out why 10% of videos were always coming up upside down. And it was actually very simple, because for 90% of the world, they hold their phone like this. The other 10% of the world holds their phone like this. There were no lefties on the team. And so nobody realized that left-handed people held their phone differently, and that's why the videos were uploaded upside down. So diversity and inclusion for us is really important, because we believe that our product is going to be better if it represents the people that are going to use it. And so working with organizations like Girls of Steel, that's promoting more diversity in technical roles, that's encouraging young women to pursue these incredible careers, you know, our partnership with them and our hope is that one day these girls that are studying computer science, that are working in robotics today, are going to be the ones that we are hiring to help design the next Aurora Driver and the next technology that we're going to be rolling out. So it's pretty incredible to have that organization that's headquartered here in Pittsburgh, and awesome to see the work that they do in robotics. But that's just one of the other components that's really important to the work that we do.
Awesome. I love it. I love it. And I just can't believe how much you guys are growing in Pittsburgh. And you know, in my former role as press secretary for the mayor from 2006-ish to 2013, I witnessed our city just sort of start bubbling and getting cool again, restaurants, okay, then Google and CMU and tech. And to see where we are now in 2020, I feel so lucky to live here.
You were there at the beginning of the Renaissance.
Hey, I was part of the Renaissance, not just there. I mean, Mark, I can remember, there's so many stories. I mean, I can remember like Google's first couple employees and, you know, Bakery Square, because Wana Capital is still a client of ours, and them deciding to break ground in 2007, that was at the height of the recession. And they're like, we're gonna break ground, and they couldn't get financing. And we were involved in like flying people from Texas to find financing for this project at Bakery Square, which now look at it, it's
booming,
bursting at the seams. I mean, there's no more office space left there, and they're going to continue to grow. So you have those two pockets of Pittsburgh. You have the East End with, you know, Google kind of, you know, having their hold there. And then now the Strip District and Lawrenceville corridor, which looks like you guys are going to be the growing there and having a strong presence there. So it's kind of, we're lucky.
We're excited about it. It's a great community.
Yeah, sometimes I feel like we're so focused on kind of the day-to-day work that it's great to have these moments where you can take a step back and be like, wow, we're actually part of the next revolution of transportation. And we don't exactly understand it, I think, when we're in that moment, kind of like what you were referring to during, you know, your time working with the mayor. But then you take a step back, kind of look at it from, you know, a wide lens. And it's really exciting. And it's exciting that it's happening in Pittsburgh. And I think our hope is that the community of Pittsburgh also takes a moment to kind of realize what's happening right in our very backyard here.
You're right. I think that's something that we all need to do, is just sort of like slow down with it, because you hear, you know, the news media is changing constantly. Farrell, I mean, you're with your background at the AP and what NPR, I mean, you really understand. And then you were a press secretary too, to a US senator. So you really, you worked in the news media, and you still do, but for a very long time. You see how much it's changing. And it's not always the case that the positive stories of growth and development get out, because it's always, I mean, the news right now is just very, it's just different. And that's all I'll say.
I'll add on to that I think one of the biggest interesting media trends I've seen over my career is that you used to be completely reliant on local, state, and national press to get your story out. And that's just not the case anymore. It doesn't mean that we don't work every single day with the media to get our story out, because we absolutely do. And that's an incredibly important validator for our company and technology. But we also spend a lot of time going directly to the consumer. And that was the case when I worked for Senator Shaheen as well. So I remember when she and I were interviewing, she basically said, like, hey, I can't get the New Hampshire reporters to cover me sometimes, because they're either covering a school football game, or they're covering a snowstorm, or they're covering Senator John Kerry, who is more well known. And even though he's in Massachusetts, he takes up a lot of the airtime. Like, how can we talk directly to our constituents? And that's when we said, like, hey, Senator Shaheen, we're going to get you on Facebook. We're going to get you on Twitter. We're going to work on the Shaheen Report, a constituent newsletter. And no longer did we have to rely on the New Hampshire paper solely to talk to constituents. And you see that very much now at Aurora as well. So in addition to, of course, working with the press, we also have our own blog where we're constantly doing deep dives into our technology. What does perception mean? How are we building our safety case, et cetera, et cetera? And we can talk directly to the people that we want to, investors, partners, and talent who we want to come join Aurora.
I love it. I mean, you hit it the nail on the head that for anyone, doesn't matter if you're a nonprofit or a company that's revolutionizing driving, you have to tell your own story and build up your own media channels. So your website, your social media, blogs, as you mentioned. Are you guys doing work in video?
Yes, video is very important too, because people really want to see and understand what this is like. So we've even been able to do some drone videos, which has been pretty cool. So you can see what it's like when a car actually does an unprotected left. So that's been, yeah, video's been huge. And also when we work with the press, we understand that reporters are interested in delivering to their readers multimedia stories. So the more kind of visuals we can get, video, photo, infographics, et cetera, the better kind of package story we can provide to our people and to our press.
Totally, especially now, because, you know, press conferences aren't really existing like they used to, and media availabilities are totally different.
It's totally different. And I think even how media companies are approaching things is really different. So I had the privilege of being at the Associated Press right around the time when social media was popping up. And they kind of looked at me and they said, hey, you were in the same dorm as Mark Zuckerberg at Harvard, right? And I was like, yeah, that's true. And they said, well, can you help us figure this out? And at that time, it was starting the Associated Press's first Twitter account and first Facebook account, and understanding how we could leverage those tools to get news out to people faster. And it's exciting just to see how that's changed for the better and for the worse since then.
And then the other side of that is, okay, so now you can, I love the Zuckerberg connection. So fun fact, so I was on semester at sea in 2004, okay? That's when Facebook started. So I was with one of, have you heard of Semester at Sea, the floating cruise ship around the world? Okay.
Yeah.
So for our audience, it's really fun. 100 days, you basically take school on a cruise ship while it's at sea, and then you're in 10 countries, and you get to see the world as a college student very quickly. And so Mark Zuckerberg's friend's name's Stan, still friends with him on Facebook. He's like, hey, my friend started this thing. Can you join it? And of course I was like, yeah. And so I was, me and a few friends at Zuckerberg were like one of the first like 2000 people to have a Facebook account. And I decided it would be smart to post a picture of me smoking a Cuban cigar as my profile picture. I was 19 years old. And for years so then I become the press secretary to the mayor, and I'm like an official role. So for years that picture was online on the internet. I haven't found it recently, don't look for it. But just this sort of, you don't realize those impacts of it. And now here we are, it's just totally amazing. So, but speaking of social media, it can truly benefit you as you get your story out and you reach consumers directly, and even business owners, businesses, things like that. But what about the worry that you have with fake news, with how quickly a story could get out there and go viral about something, let's say related to self-driving technology that maybe isn't true, and how fast that can happen and how fast your reputation could be impacted? Does that keep you up at night?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's exactly what Farrell and I work on every single day, right? It's about building relationships of trust with the media, with our stakeholders, with government, so that when somebody sees that, if it's about the industry, or even worse, if it's about Aurora, right? If it's a fake story about us as a company, that it's not going to match what people know about us, right? That somebody, whether it's in government or in the media or in the public, are going to say, this just doesn't match the what I know. It doesn't match the personality. It doesn't match the work that this company does, and that they're going to call us, right? Like, our commitment to our government stakeholders is that we will do everything possible to never surprise them. And that's something that we constantly talk with them about. Like, we will do what we can to give them a heads up before something is coming down the pipeline. In an ideal world, they never read something about Aurora in the newspaper, right? Like, they're going to have heard from us beforehand. We're going to have
somebody who worked with government. That's a very smart strategy.
And so the idea is, if they're reading something in the media that is a huge thing and we haven't given them a call about it, then please reach out to us and call us. And we'll go one step further with some of our government partners and say, if constituents are calling you and complaining about us or asking questions, let us be a resource to you. Let us help you get those answers. Call us and tell us what feedback that you're getting, because we're certainly interested in knowing that information as well. So again, it has to be, you know, my general rule of thumb with government is we never want to show up in an office when we need something from them, right? We want to build that relationship over time. We want them to trust us. We want them to know who we are as a company, how it is that we think about safety, what are our priorities, so that when those situations happen or when something goes wrong, we're gonna have that relationship that's already based on trust. But that's something that takes time to build.
Time. And what we're seeing right now play out with Google and, you know, the FTC and Facebook, you know, being a technology-based company, that has to give you guys pause and maybe do more self-reflection with regard to, you know, how are you communicating? How are you being transparent? And because you don't want to end up in the hot seat like some of those in the industry, separate industries, but it's technology, right? And I think, you know, my opinion is what's happening right now in the public with these big technology companies and their CEOs, there has to be some downstream impacts to the perception game that you guys are fighting daily. Are you worried about that at all? Are you watching it closely?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think there's a great quote by Pericles who said, "You may not be interested in government, but government will always be interested in you." So, as a general rule, I think startups need to begin to engage government far too late, like particularly in the technology sector. Right, like, I think the technology sector has this mentality of, let us innovate, let us do our work, stay out of our way. We don't want to engage with government, but we want to continue, you know, to do our work. Mm-hmm. I think that's wrong. Right. I think we have to engage with our government partners, and we have to do so early. And I think this is where I truly give a lot of the credit to our CEO, Chris Urmson. You know, Chris has done this already once with Waymo. He was the founder of the Google self-driving car project. He came out of CMU. He won the DARPA challenges. He's been in this industry, you know, over 20 years. So he understands the work that has to happen for us to be able to deploy this technology. And he has chosen to invest in our teams and to invest in the growth of our teams as we continue to grow and scale as a company so that we can do this correctly and we can engage with government in a really meaningful way, right? Like, this is not just lipstick on a pig. It's not checking a box. Like, it is a really meaningful relationship that we want to build with government to be able to do that. But I think that it's that's part of the culture that we have at the company, and it's part of our priority to be able to work with government to achieve our goal of delivering this technology broadly.
And I think you're seeing some different hiring trends. The companies that are getting this right, they don't just hire the top senior engineers to begin their company or the top product managers. They're also bringing in senior communications professionals and senior public affairs professionals because their strategy has shifted to where they are proactive. They're going to Capitol Hill. They're introducing themselves. I remember early days of Square, instead of waiting for someone to knock on our door and say, hey, mobile payments, credit cards, Bitcoin, this all seems sketchy, and conflating that all and holding a hearing that we had to appear to, we actually set up meetings proactively and met with different senators, different House members, and said, hey, did you know that Square is in your neighborhood? This is how many small businesses are using the technology. This is how much increased revenue it's driven and how many new jobs it's created. And that way, if and when a problem arose or someone in the government or someone in the media had a question, they'd already met us. They understood who we are and what we stood for. And I think the broader point there is you need to bring people along on your journey. That can feel scary. And I think that, you know, your instinct might be like, hey, let me just put my head down and work. But perception becomes reality, and you need to engage stakeholders, and you need to do so early.
Well said. Emotional intelligence for the win. I mean, that's it. And, you know, it's about being a little humble, right? And you guys are doing it right. So congrats. I know we don't have a lot of time, so I have a couple more questions and then I'm gonna say goodbye. When we talk about the digital divide and the haves and the haves and the have-nots, you know, you look at transportation. You know, you look at who has access to public transportation, who has access to vehicles, and how does that impact, you know, economic disparities. What are you guys looking at for when self-driving vehicles become our future, which it will happen, we don't know when, but it's going to happen because of companies like yourselves. What does that look like for our urban communities, for you know, our African American communities that might not have transportation access? Is it going to be better for them? I mean, what are you guys looking at?
One podcast I'd actually recommend after people listen to this one on that note is from This American Life, The Longest Distance Between Two Points. And it's about a woman who is disabled and she relies on a paratransit service called Access a Ride. And it's for passengers who are disabled and elderly. Mm-hmm. And she talks about kind of every morning going out in the snow, and maybe she waits 1 or 2 hours for her ride to come. And maybe if they drive by too quickly and they don't see her, then she has no way to flag them back. And she goes inside and she misses work that day. And that's something that we've talked about a bit as a company. People who don't have access to get to work or don't have access to get to their doctor's appointments or can't see their family on the holidays because they don't have a way to move around. And I think that's really a big motivating factor. So that's, to your question, that's absolutely something on our mind, is for people who don't have access to fantastic public transportation, whether it's because of where they live or because of a disability or because of their advanced age, that's something that autonomous technology can help solve.
So in other words, it could look like a government partnership where access, we realize, doesn't work well, and the government partners with Aurora to give better access to the disabled community. Is that, I'm sure you're not thinking of what it looks like exactly because we're not there yet, but you have to be getting those questions now.
So I do think we're thinking about exactly what that looks like, right? Like, it's part of our mission, right? I come back to our mission on this point. It's It's that broadly component. Like, we don't want this technology to just be accessible to somebody who can afford it, you know, and they want to send a car to go run an errand for them, right? Like, I think about who is the single mother who has to take three different bus routes to get to work, and if we can cut that time in by a third or in half and give her that time with her family, like, how meaningful that is. Esurance had a great study a few years ago where they talked about, like, what is the impact of self-driving technology to your average American family? Cool. And the cost savings to a family of four, I believe, was equal to seven months worth of groceries, right? So, like, if you start to put real data and real numbers behind that, the impact to families when we can make this technology accessible to everybody, right? And we think about those families that right now can't afford it, or transportation doesn't serve them. We think about somebody with a disability. We think about a senior citizen. Right. What does it mean when we take away a senior citizen's keys, and what that does to their mental health, what that does to their ability to spend time with family? If we can give them that freedom back, like, what does that mean to those families? So I think that broadly part of our mission is exactly that. It's understanding how is it that we deploy this technology so that everybody can have access to it and we can truly improve everybody's life.
I think that's that's one of the biggest sell points, right? Is how this is going to improve people's lives, like, on the everyday, you know, safety is something that matters to everyone, you know, when the fatalities matter and it, you know, hits you. But when you can start communicating about how now my grandma can come see me for Christmas, because I'm not going to drive an hour to get her. I can't, I'm cooking dinner, right? Or my kids that are going to school and I have to drive them and I lose 2 hours from my workday, now I can call an autonomous vehicle and save time and save money. It's just, I want you to tell me when it's gonna be on the roads. 2 years, 3 years, I'm kidding, I know, you can't answer that. We're gonna have to talk to Tom Wolf, right?
Look, here's what we would say on that point, and I think I addressed it briefly earlier. We're not going to set a timeline until we believe that our technology is safer than a human driver, right? That's when we're gonna deploy this technology, right? When we believe that that it is safe enough to deploy, we will deploy it because we believe that the impact is very real, right? Like, it's not lost on us that every day that passes and every year that passes that this technology is not out there, you have families that are losing loved ones to traffic fatalities. So, you know, you again, coming back to our mission, it's safely, quickly, and broadly. Right, the quickly side of it is because we know that the impact is very real to so many different families. So yes, we're going to do it safely, but as soon as we believe that it is safe enough to deploy, we want to get it out there as quickly and as broadly as possible. And it's why our partnership model is so important, right? It's why we have partnerships with companies like Uber now. It's why we're looking to partner with OEMs and truck manufacturers and logistics companies, because we're not going to do this alone. We're going to do this with our partners, and those partners are those that are going to be able to deploy this technology more broadly and more quickly because we believe that the impact is so real.
Amazing. And, you know, what I see from my little seat here is, I see Aurora becoming a huge, an even larger part of the Pittsburgh community. And, you know, we built the steel that empowered the world and built so many things from Pittsburgh that improved the entire world. And I think what you're doing here right now, we're gonna look back at this 20 years from now, 50 years from now, and be really proud, be really Pittsburgh proud. So, we really appreciate you coming onto the podcast today. Farrell, you are doing an amazing job. And I have to say that whoever's running HR at Aurora is doing the best job of them all, because two great picks here. So
thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us. And I'm going to track down that cigar photo right after this. So
I could tell you stories. I mean, that haunted me for like a good 5 years, but I don't even smoke cigars. I don't even like them. It was a cool photo. Okay, guys. Thanks for coming on. Take care.
All right, thanks.